Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
How short will President Obama's honeymoon be? Maybe shorter than you would think, considering the glow of Inauguration Day. Just look at the op-ed page of the New York Times today. Go no further than there. Paul Krugman is knocking the inaugural address for not being tough enough on the financial sector and too tough on ordinary Americans. He specifically did not like this line, which got so much general acclaim.
Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age.
And from the other side of the op-ed page, David Brooks is already challenging Obama to reject the emerging House stimulus bill, which Brooks says has too much spending and too little actual stimulus, and says that Obama's reputation is already on the line. Well, at the end of a historic week, let's talk to two historians. Neil Ferguson teaches at Harvard and Oxford. His latest book is The Ascent of Money, The Financial History of the World. He's going to have to write an addendum to that book after the last few months. Peniel Joseph teaches at Brandeis and is author of Wait Until the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America. Probably also needs an update. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
Peniel Joseph, you said this week on PBS that there are very few days in our history that actually transform the aesthetics of the nation. Do you think this Inauguration Day was one of them?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things we saw with that January 20th was the transformation, really, of the way in which we think about American democracy, especially considering the nation's tragic racial history. When we think about the first 16 presidents could have actually owned people who were descended from Africa, and when you think of a black man becoming president, that really transforms our configurations of the way in which we look at the iconography of American history.
What do you mean by aesthetics of the nation, though? Why did you use that word? That was interesting to me.
Well, I mean, when I mean that on multiple levels. On one level, the pomp and pageantry is extremely exhilarating and invigorating. The notion of a first family that's African American really surrounded, even though there was a multicultural sea of people in D.C., but really surrounded by power brokers who look like the usual suspects. So when we think about, on one level, it's going to be the iconography. On another level, it's very, very substantive in terms of when we think about the words of the founding fathers, Dr. King and different activists from Frederick Douglass to Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman have always argued for democratic principles in face of practical realities that were quite often harsh. So one of the things we see with the election of Obama and the inauguration is really the convergence between democratic principles and practices, at least at the presidential level, which is an important step towards progress.
Neil Ferguson, where were you as President Obama was being inaugurated, and what were you thinking given your grounding in history?
Well, rather unglamorously, Brian, I was in the canteen of the Harvard Business School, and although it was impossible not to be moved by the powerful symbolism that Peniel was talking about there, I must confess that I was almost equally unnerved at the prospect of the financial crisis that President Obama has inherited from his predecessor. The big challenge is in many ways comparable with that which Franklin Roosevelt faced in 1933, except that you might say Obama's come in earlier. Roosevelt came in after the Depression had in many ways done its worst, whereas Barack Obama has become president right in the eye of the storm. And I think it's going to be an extraordinary cognitive dissonance for Americans to find, on the one hand, the first African-American president, charismatic, brilliant, loved around the world, but on the other hand, the worst economic situation this country has been in since the early 1930s.
Well, on that point, and acknowledging that you have written the book Empire and other things about American power and now the ascent of money, I want to play a clip that I think is very relevant to the answer that you gave and to the moment that we're in that actually combines what we may sometimes think of as the domestic sphere of economic policy and the global sphere of foreign policy. This is the Treasury Secretary nominee, Timothy Geithner, testifying before the Senate Finance Committee at his confirmation hearing. And listen to what he says about America's economic fortunes at this time of crisis, linked to the rest of the world's.
I also believe that as America's economic fortunes become ever more closely tied to those of the rest of the world, that we need to invest more at home in helping Americans deal with the challenges of trade and technological change. And finally, I believe that our national security depends critically on our economic strength. We can have a great and positive impact on the global economy, but only if the quality of our ideas and our actions win the support of other nations.
So, Neil Ferguson, do you want to comment on the connectedness of all of that?
Well, Timothy Geithner is exactly right. They're intimately connected. The problem is that what the United States is currently embarking on is a vast increase in its borrowing from the rest of the world. Even before $825 billion of stimulus package, it's likely that the deficit for this coming year will exceed $1 trillion. In fact, $1.2 trillion is what the Congressional Budget Office estimated before the stimulus package. We're looking at a deficit that will probably be in excess of 10% of U.S. gross domestic product. Now, the problem is that we can't finance this kind of borrowing out of American savings because the savings rate has been so low for so long. The assumption seems to be that the rest of the world will pony up, as indeed Asian central banks and oil exporting countries did pony up during the Bush years. But the deficits then were smaller. And of course, the world economy was growing rapidly, so there was a great deal of surplus cash to be invested in dollar-denominated bonds. Unfortunately, the situation is now completely different, and it's inconceivable that the Asians and the oil exporters will be able to fund this huge deficit. Nobody's talking about this. All the born-again Keynesians, like Paul Krugman, seem to think that the deficit cannot be too large, that there should be no limit to the amount of money that is thrown at this financial crisis. And I think they've got a big shock coming. It's suddenly going to become clear, indeed, Brian, I think it is becoming clear, that the rest of the world is not prepared to make this kind of commitment to the U.S. dollar and to the U.S. recovery. And I think that's going to be the first big shock of the Obama presidency. And I'm afraid it's going to come much sooner than anybody expects.
Which is why I started with the question, how short will President Obama's honeymoon be? We already see these things starting to press in on him, and sometimes in critical ways. And Professor Joseph, I wonder if you think, given the crisis nature of the moment, that the overwhelmingly historical tableau that we saw on Tuesday, that all of America seemed to stop and at least take one deep breath to watch, the transformative aesthetic that you were talking about before might just be overtaken by events, and maybe very quickly.
Well, I think it's going to be overtaken by events like Professor Ferguson was talking about rather quickly. But I think he's got several audiences here. I think the American people, which has really provided such robust support, are going to be very patient. They're talking about anywhere from 2 years, giving him 2 years to get some of this stimulus package and some of this job growth and creation going. In terms of the Congress and the Senate, that's a different story, because right now he's facing a couple of problems. He's facing a Republican Party that's really feels under siege, and he'd actually be in a better position if the Republican Party was in a stronger position, because they might be more willing to compromise. And then you're facing liberal and more conservative flanks in the Congress who are Democrats. The liberals, like Niall was saying, people like a Krugman want even further stimulus. They want a bigger package, and in a way, $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion. You know, the deficit can grow however it needs to grow. Then there's conservative blue dog Democrats or yellow dog Democrats who are fiscal conservatives who think that he's spending too much. So politically, certainly I think the next 100 days he's going to have a lot of clout in the Congress. We'll see how further it goes after that. But in terms of the electorate, they're willing to give him patience. I mean, he's coming in with the highest approval rating of any president since they started polling in 1981, and people are giving him up to 2 years for this economic stimulus to take hold.
Historians Peniel Joseph and Neil Ferguson with me on WNYC at the end of this very historic week. Professor Joseph, I want to read a couple of paragraphs from the column today by conservative Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer. In general, no fan of Barack Obama-type policies and no fan of the inaugural address. His column is headlined, "A Political Stud Turns Dud." And he said there was a lack of phraseology, a lack of rhythm and timing in the speech, all this stuff. But then he writes one fascinating thing that I wonder if you have a perspective on. He says Obama's unapologetic celebration of Washington and the founders of the original imperfect union was a declaration of his own emancipation from, or better, transcendence of, the civil rights movement. The old warrior Joseph Lowery prayed for the day when white will embrace what is right, not Obama, by connecting himself with this historic address to Washington rather than Lincoln the Liberator, to Washington rather than Lincoln. Obama was legitimizing the full sweep of American history without annotation or mental reservation. If we ever have a post-racial future, this moment will mark its beginning. What do you think about that?
Well, I think Krauthammer obviously is brilliant, but I think that he's misreading the speech. I think what's important about that speech is, one, the substance matched the symbolism. And if anything, he gave a complex critique of American democracy and American history. So instead of the old right or left divide, so you've got the right who says the founding fathers were perfect, and you've got at times a generic left who says that they were nothing but flawed. What Obama does, and this is part of his brilliance, is to try and build and craft a consensus by creating a mosaic, by saying, well, on the one hand, this is this brilliant country that gave me my start. On the other hand, it's a country where sweatshop labor, where he mentioned the lash of the whip, the bitter pill of civil war and segregation. Then he mentioned the fact that his father 60 years ago couldn't have sat in a restaurant in Washington, D.C. And he brings that all together in a tableau that says this is not a weakness, this is actually a strength. So I don't think he's really looking towards a post-racial future, but he's looking towards a multicultural future where the politics of race are not so much transcended, but they're really complicated, and there's a nuanced perspective and vision that he gives to the history of America that, again, doesn't straddle along the old left-right divides.
Professor Ferguson, is this in your can at all, his invoking of Washington more explicitly than Lincoln in the inaugural or anything like this?
Well, I think Charles Krauthammer makes a good point. To me, the most impressive passages in the inaugural related to the Constitution. There was that very strong implicit rebuke of George W. Bush when he said that nothing could justify any breach of the sanctity of the Constitution. There was another moment which really made me step back, though, and that was when he declared, "We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers." Now, if anything marked a sharp break with the last administration in the address, it was surely that. And that, of course, also goes back to the very beginnings of the Republic, since the separation of religion from politics was one of the things that the Founding Fathers got right and felt most strongly about. I do think that it was clever of him not to refer everything back to the Civil War, to get out of this Lincoln paradigm, which he got rather stuck with in the transition period, and to emphasize that he belongs in a continuum that does stretch back to Washington. I agreed with that. I admired it. I think it did strike the right note.
You mentioned him invoking the Constitution, and certainly he's emphasized the Constitution with his executive orders on Guantanamo Bay and the Geneva Conventions and the treatment of detainees over the last few days. And if it is a new historical era, it was certainly marked yesterday by some of the language of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as she got sworn in. Let's listen.
We know that anything short of relentless diplomatic efforts will fail to produce a lasting, sustainable peace in either place. That is why the President and I have decided to name a special envoy for Middle East peace and a special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And she named George Mitchell as a Middle East envoy and Richard Holbrook as the Afghanistan-Pakistan envoy. Neil Ferguson, as someone who has written the book Empire and someone who has promoted the usefulness of American power around the world, supported the Iraq war from the beginning. What do you think of this change? Is it naive from your perspective, which, judging from your previous writings, maybe you would consider it to be? Do you?
Well, there is certainly some naivety in sending George Mitchell into the cauldron of the Middle East. This is surely a man who has seen his best days. And, of course, the problems that he'll confront there bear almost no relation to the problems that he confronted when he was involved with the peace process in Northern Ireland. I'm much more impressed with Richard Holbrooke's appointment, but then I rather suspect he would have made a better Secretary of State than Hillary Clinton. This is going to be a very difficult job because, as far as I can see, President Obama has no stated doctrine on American grand strategy. It's not something that he's ever said anything noteworthy about. And so we don't really know what this administration's foreign policy is, other than to try to be nicer to the rest of the world than George W. Bush was. The problem is that the Middle East is in ferment, and perhaps even more seriously, the situation in Afghanistan is teetering on the verge of disintegration. Yes. There's going to have to be a major military effort in Afghanistan. General Petraeus is already preparing that. And it's going to look a lot different, I think, to supporters of Barack Obama to find him in charge of a major scaling up of military operations in Afghanistan. I don't think this is quite what people had in mind when they flocked to Obama's standard as the man who'd opposed the war in Iraq.
But is that really true? Wasn't one of the mantras of the Democrats throughout this whole process that the central front in the war on terrorism is Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda still is, and presumably Osama bin Laden is there somewhere around the Afghan-Pakistan border, rather than Iraq? And so the troop surge is fairly popular as an Afghanistan policy?
Well, I think it's all going to depend on how it goes. Remember, Afghanistan is a harder country to crack and control by far than Iraq. So it will be quite hard, I think, for the administration to show quick results in that area. But, mm-hmm. of course, all of this in some measure is beside the point. The really important relationship between the United States and the rest of the world is with China. And already Treasury Secretary Geithner has waded in on that issue by calling the Chinese out on the question of, quote, currency manipulation. Now, that's an extremely interesting development, and I think quite a foolhardy one in many ways, given the enormous reliance that there now is on the Chinese to finance the U.S. deficit. Now, my sense is that it's that relationship which really should be the number one priority of the new Secretary of State. And if Hillary Clinton is going to be focusing on Afghanistan or, for that matter, Gaza and Israel, she may find that foreign policy is being made by the Treasury Secretary rather than by her.
Wow. Peniel Joseph, any thoughts from you on an Obama doctrine in foreign policy or a lack thereof?
No, I think there is a doctrine. I think his doctrine is basically robust diplomacy. One of the things where he was basically ridiculed and laughed at during the primaries was the notion that he'd be willing to meet without preconditions, and then he backtracked on that and said, at a time of his place with dictators around the globe. But there's a historical context, whether you look at Richard Nixon and opening up China with Nixon and Kissinger, whether you look at Lyndon Baines Johnson or Harry Truman or John Kennedy, aspects of Dwight Eisenhower in terms of the way the Korean War ended, for example. Eisenhower seized as a stalemate, and in a way, in our current political context, people might say, well, hey, he's surrendering, and why is there a divided, North and South Korea? So the Obama doctrine is really predicated on this notion that diplomacy can work backed by an approach that focuses on the carrot and the stick. So it's the carrot of incentives, it's the carrot of aid, but it's also the stick of military intervention, but not military conquest. Because one of the aspects of George W. Bush, the Bush 43 presidency that shocked the globe, was this notion of preemptive war, which really did turn the United States into an empire in terms of the perspective of other allies and opponents around the world.
Historians Neil Ferguson and Peniel Joseph for just another couple of minutes with me here on WNYC. And let me change topics entirely and Professor Joseph ask you about This story that I saw in the New York Times today, I don't know if you're familiar with this development. The headline is, Study Sees an Obama Effect as Lifting Black Test Takers. And it says, researchers have documented what they call an Obama effect, showing that a performance gap between African-Americans and whites on a 20-question test administered before Mr. Obama's nomination all but disappeared when the exam was administered after his acceptance speech and again after the presidential election. The inspiring role model that Mr. Obama projected helped blacks overcome anxieties about racial stereotypes that had been shown in earlier research to lower the test-taking proficiency of African Americans, the researchers conclude in a report summarizing their results. And what this was in total, it says 472 Americans, 84 blacks and 388 whites took the exam. Both white and black test takers ranged in age from 18 to 63, and their educational attainment ranged from high school dropout to PhD. Could there be an Obama effect on black test takers already?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen the data, but I think there is going to be some kind of Obama effect. I don't know if it's going to be as wide-ranging as lifting up SAT scores of African-Americans across the country. But certainly you've seen the fact that even when you look at the coverage of Obama, whether it's cable news coverage, there's been more excitement among African-Americans. We've changed aspects of who's covering the news, who's covering the White House with more African-American and minority reporters, and especially among young people during the campaign, the idea of having an African-American president and then him actually successfully winning the election has really energized and inspired people. So if anything, even more enduring than public policy initially in terms of an Obama effect may be just the kind of inspiration that he provides to African-Americans across all socioeconomic backgrounds. I'd like to see, in terms of class, the students who took this test, where are they coming out of? Are they coming out of the inner city? Are they coming out of the suburbs? And to see some harder data. But I do think that you're going to see some kind of enthusiasm bump among African Americans just because the president is African American, and they've never seen anything like this before. So he does instill a kind of pride in both, and frankly, in all Americans, but specifically African Americans because of the racial history of this country.
Neil Ferguson, we have 30 seconds left for a last word at the end of this historic week.
Well, I agree with everything that has just been said by Peniel Joseph. This does represent, above all, a profound shift in the perceptions of racial difference in this country, and that has to be hugely welcomed. The critical point, though, just to reiterate, is that this president, regardless of the color of his skin, is inheriting a huge challenge, both in terms of the U.S. economy and the position of America in the world. And that, I suspect, will be the thing on which he is ultimately judged by history rather than his color.
Neil Ferguson teaches at Harvard and Oxford. His latest book is The Ascent of Money, The Financial History of the World. Peniel Joseph teaches at Brandeis and is the author of Wait Until the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we're going to try to unpack the myth of the black vote on Proposition 8 in California. And then a little later in the hour, we will preview the announcement of Kirsten Gillibrand as the new U.S. Senator from New York. We will carry that announcement live. It is scheduled for noon.